listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, big horses are coming to Wisconsin. The World Clydesdale Show is coming to Madison in this weekend. We'll get an up-close look with a Clydesdale breeder. First, new estimates show Wisconsin has turned down more than $1 billion in federal money under the Affordable Care Act. That's money it could have gotten if it had fully expanded the Medicaid program. And with health care continuing to dominate the midterm elections this year, the governor's Democratic critics are saying we should reconsider our approach to the Affordable Care Act. Guy Bolton covers health policy and the business of health care for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Guy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, remind us how Wisconsin was different. We were kind of unique in how we handled a Medicaid expansion and that federal money.
Yes, Wisconsin has taken an approach unlike any other state in the country towards the Affordable Care Act and to expanding coverage. What Wisconsin did was expand eligibility for Medicaid while not accepting the additional federal dollars that were available through the Affordable Care Act. Now, the thing is that the state did that's different is under the ACA, if the state had expanded eligibility for the Medicaid program to 138% of the federal poverty level, it would have reached this, the federal government would have paid initially 100% of the cost of covering the people who gained coverage. It eventually drops down to 90% by 2020. So, say, to make it simple, let's say the feds would pay 90%. The state did not take that money. What the state did is expanded eligibility for adults without dependent children with incomes below 100% of the federal poverty level, which this year is about $12,000. By not taking, the Fed is still subsidizing their coverage because Medicaid is a federal and state program. The federal government pays about 59% of the cost of our Medicaid program or programs, because Medicaid really is a collection of programs. So what it means is that the feds are paying 59% of the cost of covering these folks. If we had expanded eligibility up to 138% of the federal poverty level, we would have gotten this enhanced match, and the feds would pay 90% of the cost.
And you tallied in this piece what that cost the state, in effect, what federal money didn't flow into the state. Talk about how you figured that out and what it came up to.
It wasn't my tally. It was the most recent analysis or estimate from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau.
Okay.
They estimated from 2014 through the current fiscal year, which ends June 30th, the total would be $1.1 billion. Now, that's the total. To put that in perspective, in the current biennium, it works out to about $200 million a year, a bit more. And that's about 1%, 1% to 1.1% of the state funds in the current budget.
What have Republicans, Governor Walker and others, said about that decision to not take this extra money?
What Governor Walker has said is that he believes people are better off in private or commercial insurance. These are health plans sold on the marketplaces set up by the Affordable Care Act. One of the reasons the state, well, the reason the state could do this is people above 100% of FPL, or excuse me, federal poverty level or the poverty threshold, are eligible for subsidized coverage through the Affordable Care Act. They can buy private health plans on the marketplaces. Previously, the state covered adults with dependent children up to 200% of the federal poverty level. What the state did with the passage of the Affordable Care Act is put all adults above 100% of the federal poverty level into these marketplaces set up through the Affordable Care Act.
Now, you quoted some people from the healthcare industry here in Wisconsin, hospitals and elsewhere. What would they like to see? What would they hope for when it comes to this available Medicaid money?
supporters of what the state has done have said that, you know, people have more choices in the health plans available through the Affordable Care Act. The health plans, again, sold on the marketplaces. These plans offer better access. They pay higher rates. This is something that Speaker Robin Voss said. At the same time, the Wisconsin Hospital Association and the Wisconsin Medical Association have long encouraged the governor and lawmakers to accept the additional federal money to make the changes in our and how we approach the Affordable Care Act that will allow us to receive this enhanced match or additional federal dollars available through the Affordable Care Act.
Now, people may have noticed we're in an election season. Is this something that's been picked up as an issue in the race for governor in particular?
Tony Evers has said that he would support accepting the additional federal dollars through the Affordable Care Act. Mary Burke said the same in the last campaign. We did a Q&A in 2016. This was on this issue. We have written about it, you know, a number of times since 2014. So, you know, it's kind of been a perennial issue.
Well, I want to ask about what might have been different had the state taken this money. And this it sounds like, if I'm hearing you right, really it's those people over 100% of the federal poverty line, instead of being covered more directly by the state with that extra Medicaid money, they're out on the affordable health care market, and they may be receiving subsidies from the federal government, depending on where they are above the poverty line. How much different would it be if we had taken the money for them?
In the Milwaukee area, you can buy a health plan on the marketplaces that essentially doesn't cost you anything. The subsidies will offset the cost of both the deductibles and the premiums. That is in the Milwaukee area. I don't know if that holds for all areas of the state. In Dane County, UW Health has given money to the United Way that for people with incomes up to 150% of the federal poverty level, they will pay the premiums. We did not get into that in this story, but there's about 2,000 people in Dane County who are in that program. One of the criticisms of what the state has done is if there is a premium, people with these very low incomes, will sometimes miss payments and or not have money for any deductibles. But again, I am not sure if at that income level throughout the state, if there are any premiums or deductibles.
We'll leave it there for now. Guy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Guy Bolton, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel healthcare reporter. He was with us to talk about a new report showing Wisconsin has turned away more than $1 billion in money it could have gotten under the Affordable Care Act. He reported on that and the arguments for and against Medicaid expansion in the state. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on a scary movie.
It's primetime scary movie season. And if you're the type of person who loves the campy horror B-movies of yesteryear, you're in luck. WXPR's Mackenzie Martin tells us about a forgotten yet beloved thriller filmed in the Northwoods.
It's the summer of 1978 in Oneida County. 15-year-old Ed Phoebus is driving his grandfather around town without a driver's license, and his grandfather has an interesting request. He wants his grandson to drive him to a movie set. He snagged a role as an extra.
He might have been in other scenes, but they got cut. But the one scene, you know, it's after the lady screams standing next to the car. I think it's Gloria DeHaven screaming next to the car.
A creature from the bog.
Gloria DeHaven was just one of the Hollywood stars that came to Oneida County that summer in 78. Bog the movie also starred Aldo Ray and Marshall Thompson. Overall, it's a pretty obscure movie about a lake monster who was awakened with a taste for human blood. A local sheriff and biologist, among others, spend the whole movie trying to stop the monster.
You know what it is?
Well, there's always been a lot of stories about that lake.
It was shot in and around Harshaw, Minocqua, and Lake Tomahawk, but it wasn't widely released or particularly well-liked.
They had a really good time. I can tell you, that's the one thing I remember is they were having a really good time in all the places up here. You imagine people like of that caliber coming up here back then. There was stuff up here, but it was still kind of backwoods and stuff like that. And
the way the movie ended up being shot in the Northwoods is still a bit of a mystery. Phoebus says it mostly happened because of a cinematographer that lived on Bearskin Lake at the time.
he had all these autographed pictures in his basements and all these, you know, awards and stuff. But he's the one that convinced them to come up here and do a movie. He didn't have any input on what movie or anything like that.
Phoebus has shown the film a few times locally to people interested, but otherwise he hasn't thought about Bog too much for the last 40 years. Then, a few years back, he met possibly the biggest fan of the film ever.
So we were running a resort. He was doing research, so he came to the resort that they actually filmed some of the movie in. I think I had the disc and stuff like that, and he's just, his eyes just lit up. And he started talking to me about it. He gets all crazy, and I was like, wait a second.
Possibly the biggest fan of Bog is Todd Brown, so much so that he recently put together a 40th anniversary screening of Bog in Rhinelander. Brown says growing up in Ohio, he and his friends would watch the movie over and over again.
I think I was 16 the first time I saw it. It was my first exposure to, like, a truly awful movie.
Brown has done a lot of research on the movie, and he says many of those involved never even saw the finished product, including the director Don Kiesler, who Brown tracked down one day.
He was so surprised when I called him one day and I said, "Hey, yeah, I really love your movie, Bog." He's like, What are you talking about? That movie got finished?"
According to Brown, Don Kiesler called cut on the final day of filming and had nothing to do with the final production of the movie. Brown says he wanted to host a screening in Rhinelander since the movie was never shown in theaters in Oneida County. He says it's not that it's the best, worst movie ever. It definitely isn't. But it's the first bad movie he ever saw, and that means something. Every time Brown watches a bad movie, and he watches a lot, he wants it to feel like the first time he watched Bog, and it never quite does.
I just have so many fond memories of just growing up, coming of age, and watching this movie. And there's just another thing about, like, the earnestness of it. It's just so, it's just, like, pure. You can tell the people that made it, they really set out to make a good little effective horror film here.
Hell, man, aside from the guy that owns his boat, this lake ain't seen action in years.
It's true. The makers of the film didn't set out to make something bad. But while Bog may be a poorly produced film, its 40th anniversary screening recently was well attended. And for those with a connection to northern Wisconsin, it will always serve up a hefty dose of 1970s nostalgia.
Mackenzie Martin is a host and editor at WXPR in Rhinelander. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the World Clydesdale Show is coming to Wisconsin. It'll be at Madison's Alliant Energy Center October 25th through 28th. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked to Kathy Bain recently, executive director of the Clydesdale Breeders of the USA.
Kathy, what is the history of the Clydesdale breed?
The history of the Clydesdale breed. The Clydesdale breed is a heavy draft horse. It's part of the draft horse world. They had evolved in Scotland, actually, during the 19th century. And they were a powerful horse with a sizable hoof and a perfect build for the Scottish farmland and the coal fields in Lanarkshire and for all kinds of heavy hauling. And they branched out into other countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States.
And what has the history been here in the U.S.?
The Clydesdale Breeders of the United States, they were incorporated in 1879 and have been working on promoting the Clydesdale breed through purebred registry, publications, shows, you know, public promotion. And so the Clydesdale Breeders has been working a long time to help the Clydesdale horse evolve.
So you said in Scotland they were really well suited for agricultural work there. Mm-hmm. Were they used for that also in North America?
Yes, they were. They were. And then as everything evolves, you know, we got the tractors and we got equipment that would take over that work. Some people still use them as a workhorse, but they've become more of a, you know, a purebred that is to breed, to show, and to for enjoyment more than actual work because of all the tractors and industry.
Well, and I have to say, ever since I knew that I was going to be talking with you about this, I've had kind of a nonstop soundtrack in my head of that Budweiser commercial and the beautiful footage of, you know, these huge but so elegant horses, you know, prancing in front of the Budweiser beer wagon. Were they used here in Wisconsin? Certainly, we have a huge beer history. Were they associated with the beer industry?
Absolutely. Anheuser-Busch has really done our breed proud. They have promoted the Clydesdale horse and its majestic qualities to a T. They have become national icons of the Budweiser Clydesdales are respected and by everyone. So they have really pushed the breed out there, and they have promoted the beauty of the breed, you know, the personality and agility of the breed. They've really helped with public awareness and made the Clydesdale breed one of the most favorite draft horses.
Well, tell us about the breed, the horses themselves. What kind of temperament, for instance, do they have?
Well, the Clydesdale breed is known as the gentle giants. That's kind of like a slang word that we mm-hmm. use, but it is true. These big horses are very gentle. They're very smart and very trainable. They're very eager to please, and they are a people horse. I mean, not only being beautiful, they're just a pleasure to be around.
They're so big. Are they able to be ridden?
Yes. Riding has really evolved in the last decade, and at our World Clydesdale Show, we have really gone into that versatility of the breed. That's kind of what we're promoting in our industry now, because we all see them in harness, you know, pulling the big Budweiser wagon. We see mares and foals in the pasture, and there's nothing more beautiful than that. Mm. But they also are very trainable and they're good athletes. So we have evolved in the riding, Western, English, dressage. We'll have a jumping class, barrel racing. There's nothing that a Clydesdale really can't do.
Wow. Because, yeah, an animal of that size, it's you might think that they would be less agile, but it sounds like that's not the case. How much bigger are they than an average, I don't even know what an average horse is, but they certainly are one of the bigger breeds, aren't they?
They are. The draft horses are all bigger breeds. There's different breeds within the draft horse industry. But a Clydesdale horse can get all the way up to 18-plus hands, and they can weigh up to a ton when they're all matured out. So
that's over 2,000 pounds,
yeah,
right?
That is. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We said, you know, they can weigh as much as a Volkswagen Beetle car, you know. But so they're very, very big, which makes their agility the same as a light horse, but like the barrel racing won't go as fast because they're so much bigger. But the agility and ability to do that kind of discipline is there.
We're talking with Kathy Bain. She's executive director of the Clydesdale Breeders of the United States. And we're talking about the 2018 World Clydesdale Show, which is happening in Madison, October 25th to the 28th. And one of the really characteristic things about Clydesdales are those huge hooves. How did those develop, or is that common with draft horses?
The big hooves, all the draft breeds have a big hoof. They are big animals, and for the work that they do, they have to have a big hoof to support their weight and to pull. And so if you think about a draft horse, their hoof is going to be about as big as your dinner plate. They have to have that underneath them to support their body and to do what they do. They have to have that good big foot on them.
How did you get involved with Clydesdales, Kathy?
My family, we are a fourth-generation family here in northern Illinois. My parents rented a farm years ago, and the landlord happened to have Clydesdale horses here. Thus, we have evolved from that. We got involved in that, and we tease, if you've ever been bitten by the Clydesdale bug, it's something that you don't ever get over. Once you get involved with the breed, it's a necessity in life, kind of. So that's how we got involved, and we're going on a fourth generation now here on our farm, raising the Clydesdale horses.
I saw that 600 Clydesdales from around the world will be at the World Clydesdale Show. How do you transport a horse that big?
Yes, we had actually 650 Clydesdale horses, and we call it a world show. So the horses usually come by semi-truck or truck and trailer. Some people have so far a journey. They will go so far in a day, and then they'll lay over at a what they call a horse hotel, so the horses can rest and get their nourishment they need, and then back in the trailer. So through the United States and Canada, they use semi-trucks or, you know, the trailer, just a horse trailer. And sometimes when you export from overseas, we like to know that we're international partners on keeping this breed going. So most of the time, if you bring a horse from another country, it's by air freight.
So they literally are getting onto a plane.
Yes. Yes, they do. We have some horses from other countries here that have been purchased and imported into the United States prior, so they're already here. We had a couple horses, one from South Africa that was supposed to join us, but the protocol on the blood work is so stringent that that horse got hung up in quarantine. But we have many, many people from all over the world coming to this event.
And Kathy, as we wrap up, if people come to the World Clydesdale Show in Madison, what will they see?
Well, the full schedule is on our website for the worldclydesdaleshow.com, but they are going to see a flavor of the versatility of the Clydesdale horse. You will see horses shown at halter, just in the lead classes. You will see all the riding, the jumping, barrel racing, dressage. You will see hitches from the single cart up to 8 horse hitches. So it's a well-rounded show with over 100 classes.
Wow.
Well, the breed.
It sounds really interesting. Thank you so much for telling us about the Clydesdales and the show.
Well, thank you for having me. We're excited about it and happy to come to Madison.
That was Kathy Bain, Executive Director of the Clydesdale Breeders of the United States. She talked to Central Time Executive Producer Judith Sears-Poisson about the 2018 World Clydesdale Show. It's taking place in Madison, October 25th through 28th at the Alliant Energy Center. Now, one thing you've probably heard a lot since 2016 is just how divided this country is. There's been a lot of coverage of the partisan divide in the media. Politics has been really heated, and social media paints a pretty grim picture, too. But a new study out from the group More in Common says there's actually much more room for common ground among Americans than we might think. Stephen Hawkins is the lead researcher on the group's latest study, Hidden Tribes, which takes a closer look at polarization in the United States. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we hear this story about polarization a lot, and there's a lot of evidence, at least on the surface. What made you want to dig deeper into this?
We thought that the story of polarization had lots left to be told. Specifically, we thought that there is a lot of psychological underpinnings to what's going on in the United States that hadn't really been surfaced. And we thought that dividing the country into just Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, or into demographic groups, white people versus minorities, men versus women, wasn't getting it enough of the picture. So we teamed up with a social psychologist who's based at Yale, and we conducted a really robust study with 8,000 participants who took our online study, and then we followed up with a large number of focus groups and in-depth interviews to really probe under the surface and see if we could get a richer picture of what was happening in our country.
Don't always want to talk too much about methodology, but it's kind of interesting here because you didn't ask the polling questions that people might be used to. Do you vote for candidate A or B? Are you a Democrat or a Republican? Are you for or against this particular issue? How did you go about questioning to dig deeper here?
Yeah, we tried to focus primarily on what are called core beliefs. This is a set of things that are more fundamental to who a person is than their simple attitudes towards the typical political issue of the day. So we ask questions that really get at people's identity. How do people wake up in the morning? Do they think of themselves first as a Christian and as an American, or do they wake up and feel first that they're a person of color and a woman? We wanted to really get a nice sense of the deepest parts of people's psychology. So we ask questions about identity, about people's moral values. We ask questions about their preferred parenting styles. And we use these variables, there are almost 60 of them, together with some questions about their political behavior to get a more fundamental understanding of who people were. And then we used a kind of fancy statistical process called agglomerative hierarchical clustering, and that allowed us to find the patterns in those data so that we could make the groupings that became the seven tribes.
And you found seven different groups, as you say, and those people who we might think of as the polarized electorate, the ones you might think of, I don't know, calling into a political talk show, say, they exist, but they're less than 10% on either edge, the furthest to the left and the furthest to the right. They exist, but they're really not the whole story, you found out.
They're not the whole story. What we found is we have seven groups. Right at the center, we have a group called the politically disengaged. This is about one in four Americans. And there are there's lots of variety within that group, but these are people who are primarily focused on their day-to-day lives or on other things. They're not really focused on politics, they're not posting about it, and they don't vote very often. And then moving from the center, we have moderate group, we have a passive liberal group, and we have a traditional liberal group. And all of these together form what we call the exhausted majority. And this is a group of people who, they don't agree on everything politically. Some of them say they're Democrats, some of them say they're Republicans, others are indifferent or call themselves independents. But what they do have in common is that they're a little bit more ideologically flexible. They don't think all the same way. They don't read from a script on the left or the right about how problems need to be solved. And they also feel forgotten by the political debate of the day. And I think the most important point about them is that they feel really fatigued by the political partisan bickering of this moment and really are eager for something new and something that's more compromise-oriented, something that isn't as bitter and acrimonious.
And something interesting, on the edges here, you've got progressive activists, devoted conservatives on the opposite end, but then you've got traditional conservatives and traditional liberals, but they aren't really a mirror image of each other. They kind of function differently. Those traditional conservatives, you find, are in many ways more engaged. They're not as frustrated as the traditional liberals. What's going on?
The traditional liberals and the traditional conservatives do have something in common, and that's that they are more or less of the same generation. These tend to be of the baby boomer generation, a little bit older, and they also tend to think of themselves as Americans. They have pride in being American, especially on the conservative side. But where they differ is in their emotions towards the country today. Traditional conservatives, this is 19% of the population, these are people who will describe themselves as Republicans. They're primarily supportive of Trump. And so this isn't a moment where they feel only frustration at the United States. They also feel like their voices are being heard. They feel as if the country is moving in a positive direction in many ways. And so they're not as frustrated and fatigued by this political moment as the traditional liberals are, who feel very much that the country is headed in the wrong direction. And I think if we had done this study, for instance, in 2009 or 2010, in the heyday of the Tea Party, in the early years of the Obama presidency, we would have defined this exhausted majority group a little differently. And I think the traditional liberals would have been more on the positive side, and the traditional conservatives would have made up part of this exhausted, frustrated majority.
Talking to Stephen Hawkins from the group More in Common about a new report from the group. He's the lead researcher. It's called Hidden Tribes, saying the story of polarization in the United States, there's a lot more going on when you dig in. Stephen, I want to dig into some of these groups more, but I want to ask a big picture question. As you say, a lot of these people are in this exhausted majority. What can we do with this information? What can we do to engage them and maybe depolarize, maybe get along a little better?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that there's really a problem in our political discourse. We asked a lot of questions about this in our study, and one of the dynamics that was really striking to us was that people both recognize that there is a problem of hate speech in our country and it needs to be addressed, and that there's a problem of political correctness, of policing speech and of people taking offense very easily. These dynamics are really difficult to navigate for most people, and it's causing them to retreat from politics. It means they don't want to post online, they don't want to engage in the conversation at work or over the dinner table with their family at Thanksgiving. And that is a fundamental obstacle to us being able to work together, because when we're not having those conversations, we're not seeing the best in each other, and we're free to draw on these caricatures, these kind of cartoon versions of the other side that make them out to be worse than they are. I think the second thing we need to do is recognize that there really are fundamentally different worldviews, different cultures and stories that we're telling on the left and the right. On the left, there's a story that's about allowing the individual to prosper and flourish and have a lot of freedom, that we need to be careful about authority because too much authority is suffocating and it's oppressive, and we need to be respectful and focus on freedom and equality. That's a good story. On the right, there's a story that says, let's be careful. Individuals left to their own devices can be selfish. They can make mistakes, and they need good leadership. They need strong families. They need strong culture. They need religion. They need education to bring out their best selves. Self-discipline is very important. Family is very important. And those are two stories that both have degrees of merit and need to be told at the same time. And instead, they're vilified. The worst versions of these stories are used to characterize each other, and we don't hear what each side is trying to bring to the table.
I want to jump to this group, 1 in 4 people, as you say, the politically disengaged. And I've heard over the years people from the left and the right saying, there's all these people out there. We know they agree with us. If we just activate them, we're going to win every election. It's way more complicated than that. What did you learn about this quarter of Americans who fall into this politically disengaged category?
Well, this is a group that is disproportionately young. They're the group that's most likely to have children under the age of 18 that they're still raising. This is a group that includes a lot of people who are lower income, who have less education. For them, politics and national stories, a little bit of a luxury for their time. They're more focused on raising their children, making sure they get to their shift at work, making sure they finish their degree. And so they're not as engaged in politics. They're focused on other things. They're also a group that's quite discouraged, and they don't see they see politics as both intimidating on the one hand because it's complex and it's a foreign world in some ways, but also as a place that is frustrating because they don't see a route for their engagement. They don't see a payoff for their participation in politics. This is also a group that is a bit prone to conspiratorial thinking. We asked some questions in our study that gauge people's propensity to believe in stories about conspiracies at a grand scale, and this is a group that gravitates towards those as well. So it's a low information group. They don't, with regards to politics, and they're not very active politically and across the board. So they're not thinking about politics, they're not watching it on TV as much, they're not posting about it on social media, and they're not voting very often either.
We're talking about polarization in the United States with Stephen Hawkins, lead author of a new study called Hidden Tribes. He's with the group More in Common. It dug beyond the left-right debates, this study did, and found a lot of different groups of people in the United States, 7 of them to be precise. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the extremes on both ends of the political spectrum get too much attention? Do you feel like your views are left out, like a middle ground is left out sometimes? Do you identify with one of the groups you've heard our guests talk about? Do you feel like, hey, yeah, I am in that politically disengaged group? Tell us why you don't feel like politics is part of your life. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephen Hawkins. He's part of the group More in Common, which is out with a new study looking at American identity and political polarization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel it? Do you feel like we're more politically polarized in this country than other points in your life, in our history? Do you have a hard time talking about anything vaguely political? You don't want to do it because you're worried that you're going to start a fight with someone on one side or the other. And do you feel like when you look at the politicians out there, the parties out there, are they talking to you? Are they speaking for you? Or do you feel like they're missing your perspective? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Stephen, you talk a little bit in the piece about distrust of the media among groups across the political spectrum. It varies, but do you think there are some lessons for how those of us in the media talk about these issues?
Well, it's a bleak picture. I don't know that I have much that's going to encourage you from this conversation. One of the things we found was that there's a lot more alignment about who are the bad media than there are about who are the good media. So we asked about, for instance, MSNBC and about Fox, and the conservatives are sure that MSNBC is biased, and 9 out of 10 agree on this. They don't completely agree that Fox is worth listening to. And the reverse is true among the progressive activists for Fox. They completely think it's biased, and they have mostly positive views towards MSNBC. We also found that there's some relevance to generation. The traditional liberal group, which is, again, a little bit older, more of the baby boomer generation, they still have a little bit of confidence in the media and in our political institutions more generally. They're less pessimistic, and so they're probably a key audience for traditional media. And, you know, we asked about a lot of different issues. Specifically, we asked about race and social justice, immigration, sexual harassment, sexual assault. And we asked whether people thought that these issues were being captured well in the media or whether there was bias in the way that they were being spoken about. And on every single issue, we found that a majority of Americans said that the mainstream media, and that was the term we used, had bias in the way that they presented these issues. And I think it's a really difficult challenge to face, and it doesn't help that the more niche media that's more oriented towards one set of ideologies or the other is likely to criticize their own side of the aisle if they don't turn in their favor in their coverage of the stories.
Let's go to our callers now. Gail is with us in Black River Falls. Gail, hello.
Hello.
What do you think, Gail?
Well, I travel a lot for work. And in the past, you did not sit next to anybody and talk about anything serious. You didn't talk religion, race, or politics. But now I can be sitting next to somebody for 3 hours, get off of that plane, and not know if they're from the right or the left. We only agree that we don't trust the government to do anything.
Okay, Gail, thanks for the call. So I don't know if that's the common ground you're hoping for, Stephen, but a common concern, a worry about the effectiveness, the operations of our government.
Yeah, I think that's the exhausted majority speaking there, just a fatigue with politics, a frustration at what's happening in Washington, D.C., and not enthusiastic about the left or the right. I'm sure there's a lot of people who could agree on that.
Thanks for the call, Gail. We'll go next to Jay on the line in Green Bay. Jay, hello.
Hello.
Well, what did you want to bring up, Jay?
So I'm a trans woman, and the memo that was recently released basically stated that the administration doesn't believe that we deserve civil rights. So my question is, how do we bridge this gap of complacency where you have people on the right side that are not acting on it, ignoring this very important issue to people on the left side? And it's, you know, far ranging from just the traditional conservatives to the extreme conservatives.
Jay, thanks for the call. So these political issues that, in Jay's case, say will affect their life in a very significant way.
There's a really big gap here, I think, on a lot of questions that have to do with gender roles and that have to do with sexuality. On the conservative side of the spectrum, and that would include the devoted conservatives and the traditional conservatives, they're primarily drawing their moral compass with questions related to gender and sexuality from a biblical worldview, which doesn't have much to say to support transgender identity. And so I think there's a lot of conversations that need to be had in order to bring that bring a common understanding on that issue for sure.
Jay, thanks a lot for calling in. Stephen, I want to talk about how political parties navigate all this. We hear in primary campaigns, often moderate candidates are not rewarded for being moderate. In general elections, we hear the mantra, you have to rally the base, appeal to the base, your core supporters. Is that part maybe of what leaves the exhausted majority out of the political discussions?
Without a doubt. There was a piece that came out today written by Cass Sunstein, a renowned professor from Harvard, about our study. And in it, he wrote that the real problem isn't tribalism, it's partyism. And that was one of his main points, that there are institutionalized mechanisms in the parties that incentivize and reward the behavior of being more partisan and being more ideological rather than of seeking common ground. And that's absolutely true. It's true from the level of the way the congressional districts are drawn by parties, the way that political primaries and caucuses are run all the way through to the way that fundraising happens at a national level. There's structures across the country, across the political system in the country that reward that ideological behavior as opposed to seeking common ground. And that's certainly a big set of the drivers that have brought us to this point.
Talking to Stephen Hawkins, lead researcher on the study Hidden Tribes, a project of the group More in Common, looking at political polarization in the United States. I want to talk to a group, and this is a group that sometimes feels mythical, again, from my perspective, hosting a political call-in show, the moderates. They are out there.
They are out there. They are 15% of Americans, according to our study. They tend to be of an older generation. These are people who are politically involved. They vote in local elections. But they split right down the middle on a lot of questions, whether it's on immigration or questions about social justice. One thing that's interesting about them is even though they split between being Democrat, being Republican, or independent in the way that they behave and they identify, they do have, as an older generation, a bit of reservation about the direction that our country is moving in culturally. There's not a sense that the youngest generations have really landed on great ideas and are moving forward with them to make the country a better place. There's some concern that things are getting worse, that the family structure in particular is something which is eroding to the detriment of our country. And so the moderates can be a little bit more socially conservative, a little bit more hesitant, but they are right down the middle when it comes to a lot of the major policy questions and debates that happen in our country.
You've mentioned generational differences a couple times. Where do we see the most older Americans concentrated? Which groups are proportionally younger out of these seven tribes?
Mm-hmm. This will probably follow a lot of people's experience. The devoted conservatives and traditional conservatives, as well as the traditional liberals, are the older generations. Again, I'm speaking on averages here. There are older people in every group. And the younger generations are better represented among the passive liberals, the politically disengaged, and the progressive activists. So more one way of thinking about it is if you're young, you tend to either opt out of politics or become quite progressive. And if you're older, you tend to be either you lean liberal or you're quite conservative and religious. Those are the kind of patterns that we saw to simplify it.
Now, you could look at this report, Stephen, and say you got a couple groups on either side. They're not going to talk to each other. You got a bunch of people who feel disconnected. They're giving up on politics. You could read this and be pretty pessimistic. I understand you see some reasons for hope here. What are they?
Well, 77% of Americans think that our differences aren't so big that we can't work together. And more than two-thirds of Americans think that, or they want their side to listen and compromise rather than to just stand and fight. And, you know, there's a lot of frustration in the country right now. It's not a positive, optimistic emotion. It is a negative emotion. It is anxiety and frustration and fear. But that fear, if channeled correctly, could bring about a willingness to behave differently, to think differently, to challenge ourselves, to listen to perspectives that we don't always hear. And so I see reason to be hopeful, both because of people's willingness to compromise and because that people aren't all as invested in their political identities as people are on the wings, but also because there's a broad recognition that we are at a low point. A lot of people told us this was the lowest point in their lifetimes in terms of how divided the country has felt. And as a result, they are eager to hear from new voices and hear new ideas.
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Stephen Hawkins is the lead researcher on the study Hidden Tribes, a project of the group More in Common, looking at polarization in the United States today and digging in more into the details of what we think about our political world.